Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, January 30th. A ruling from the Intermediate Court of Appeals takes the land board to task for not upholding public access rules and its responsibility to the public trust. This week, we're featuring perspectives of local nonprofits following the start to a very confusing week. An order freezing federal grants and loans sent groups scrambling before it was blocked in court. We learn a bit about a medical mystery. Why are there so many cases of a certain eye disease on the Big Island? And we learn more about the dangers of rubbing your eyes. We meet an active senior with a rare form of vision loss, how she adapted to going blind, and what others can learn from her journey. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A ruling from the Intermediate Court of Appeals over public access takes the state land board to task over upholding public trust law. In 2018, Honolulu attorney David Frankel sued over violations at Kahala Beach Resort, and the appeals court just issued an opinion yesterday. Frankel talked to us this morning about what this means.
Intermediate Court of Appeals issued an opinion. We held that the Board of Land and Natural Resources essentially breached its public trust duties when it authorized the Kahala Hotel to make exclusive use of a portion of land designated to be used as public beach. Back in 2018, a lawsuit was filed because Bilanar let the hotel occupy and exclude the public from land that had been set aside as a public beach, even though a portion of it has been grassed over. And the court basically criticized the board's decision-making process, that the board did not begin with a presumption in favor of public use. Instead, the board sort of prioritized financial gain over the need to protect public trust resources. Also, the court criticized the board for not considering alternatives. For example, the hotel could have put its stuff on its own property rather than on public land.
And to be clear, now the hotel has pulled back its footprint where it was using public land for commercial use?
Since 2017, the hotel's use of public land has significantly decreased. It's been incremental. They used to have basically a restaurant on the public beach from which the public was excluded. That was pulled back in, I think, sometime in 2018. They used to put these large cabana structures both on the sand. Well, first of all, they were on the sand near the water. Those were pulled back and put on the grassy area, which is public land. And those cabana structures were also removed at a certain point. Then they had, you know, presetting approximately, I can't remember the number now, approximately 78 beach chairs on mostly the grassy area there, which is called Lot 41, which is public land. Most of that presetting has been pulled back. They were having weddings on this public land with a gazebo. That has stopped. So a lot of the improper uses of public land there have been pulled back significantly since approximately 2017.
And full disclosure, you know, when I was a TV news reporter, I recall doing stories over there and talking to people who were blocked from walking along the pathway there because there was a wedding that was happening. And I believe that the people then were routed through the kitchen to avoid disrupting the services and the reception.
And that actually happened to me as well. I didn't go to the kitchen. I just couldn't. They attempted to stop me from crossing the public land, and I refused to abide by the orders of the Kahala security, and I continued on. So yeah, that is definitely a practice that was going on.
And so you brought this lawsuit yourself. Why is this public access issue so important to you?
Well, it's important because it's the beach and our beaches are special. Unlike some places on the mainland, beaches here are the public's. They can't be privatized. I think there was an effort by the hotel to exclude the public and make the resort more private, more exclusive, what have you, and to keep the public out. And that's just wrong. This is public land. It was actually dedicated to be used as public beach. In the 80s, I believe, part of the sandy area was grassed over. And so some people may not think it's a beach or may not think it's public land, but it is. There are now very small little signs on the ground, little plaques that mark the property line between the Kahala's land or the hotel's land and the public's land. And so it's pretty easy to see. That line is pretty close to where the structures are themselves.
Well, what is the message? I mean, as far as, you know, public access, presetting of chairs on beaches, what should people know?
If the Board of Land and Natural Resources is going to authorize a private entity to exclude the public from this land or similar land, they have to go through an analysis, a pretty sophisticated analysis where you look at alternatives, where you begin with the presumption the public should have the use of the land. They're going to have to justify a decision like that. You know, the primary impact of this decision is it's going to affect board decision making, but it also should empower citizens to challenge when presetting occurs on beaches. You know, the legislature passed a law, I think it's 2 years ago now, maybe it's three, which bans presetting of beach chairs on Oahu and Maui, but it doesn't ban it on Kauai and the Big Island. In theory, then, the state should not be authorizing any hotel to preset anywhere, given, first of all, the law passed by the legislature, but secondly, this decision, which will restrict that from happening now also on the Big Island and Kauai as well.
That was Honolulu Attorney David Frankel talking to us about a ruling that the Intermediate Court of Appeals handed down yesterday over public beach access. The State Attorney General's office said it, along with the Department of Land and Natural Resources, are reviewing the decision and considering the next step. It declined comment as it says the case is being sent back to circuit court. Full disclosure, Kahala Resorts is an underwriter of HPR. This is a conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukauai,
o'ahu, omolokai, olanai, omau, ukaho'olabe, ohawai.
For today's backyard quiz, we're focusing on a pair of ring-tailed lemurs with a surprising connection to the Hawaii comedy scene. Ring-tailed lemurs are endangered primates native to Madagascar. You can recognize them by their round yellow eyes and their black and white tails, which can stretch out for 2 feet. Lemurs are also known for being one of the most vocal primates, with calls that can be described as meows, purrs, growls, and even barks. But did you know that two lemurs called the Honolulu Zoo home? Well, in 2020, a set of ringtail lemur twins were born at the zoo, and they were named after two homegrown funny men. These local comics made a name for themselves and making cameos in the Hawaii Five-O reboot and performing together in the 2012 Na'ali'i of Comedy Tour. For today's quiz, can you tell us the names of the lemur twins at the Honolulu Zoo? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HPR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
Live from the Atherton, this weekend, HPR presents Kilia. This concert is part of HPR's Mele Hawaii performance series. Kilia is performing this Saturday at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m., and Sunday at 2 p.m. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
Child and Family Service is one of many nonprofits this week that wondered about a move by the Trump administration to freeze federal grants and loan programs. An 11th-hour reprieve has eased some of the immediate concern, but not of the threat of cuts. We talked to the new CEO of Child and Family Service. Amanda Pump has worked with the organization for a decade and sat down with us early this week to talk about its history and future.
We're celebrating our 125th year of helping Hawaii's families. So back in 1899, we started, and we had one mission: strengthen families and help the keiki of Hawaii. And so we've done that ever since. So I think that's the most exciting this last year. On the horizon, though, we're scaling, we're kind of growing programming to better help serve Hawaii and the needs. And so that's been very exciting for this to plan and kind of set that in motion for the next year.
And so, yeah, what types of programs will you be launching?
You know, one in particular is really helping to better support military families. But way back in World War I, think about the last 125 years and how much we've seen here in Hawaii. We are really honing in now on how to better support the military population. Throughout the last 125 years, they kind of entered our programs, but we weren't really designed to take care of them the way that they deserve to be taken care of. And so there's about 187,000 military families that are local residents and their families here in Hawaii. And so we really wanted to develop programming that would help really take care of those mental health needs and unique needs that they have.
You know, most people might think, well, doesn't the military offer programs, you know, to help their soldiers and sailors and their dependents?
You know, I would say that they do. There are some services to offer for their service members, but ours is pretty unique. And so what makes us unique, per se, is that even if someone wore the uniform for one day, no matter their discharge, they're eligible for service. Not every program that the military offers has that. They oftentimes exclude the service member based on discharge. That has recently changed. And then it doesn't matter if the service member is enrolled into care. We help their family. So if it's the spouse that wants to enroll, the kids, if it's Hanai family that just kind of identifies as being a service member's family, we'll take those in too. So there's multiple access points. Our belief is, hey, in order for a service member to get care, sometimes we have to work with a family as a unit. That strengthens the whole family. It strengthens our communities, and it helps that service member sometimes get into viable options.
Right, because you want to help the children if there's some weak link, you know, into what that unit needs, right?
Yeah. And the cool thing is, you know, these families come in with unique hardships, deployment, moving around state to state for kids, you know, really transitioning into a new school system, feelings of being lonely and in isolation because we sometimes don't have that natural support system here available to them in Hawaii. So the cool thing about our military family services is that we hire military wives, former service members who are now identifying as veterans. We hire those that have the lived experience because we believe we are who we serve and we want to help, and it just makes services so much better.
Oh, because they can relate, right? When you're without your spouse for however many months because they're out at sea or, you know, in deployment fighting a war somewhere. Yeah, it's tough on the family unit.
Yeah, it's definitely tough. And, you know, then they don't have to come in and kind of explain what they've been through. It's kind of like, hey, I got you. I've been in a similar deployment circumstance. And then for the family members, they have their own unique you know, needs too, where, hey, not everyone had to travel around the country, sometimes even the world, and have to reroute themselves every 3 years plus. So having someone be able to just understand you before you're even telling your story helps the healing process and mainly expedites the healing process.
Yeah, because you've got situations where, let's say, the mom is the service member, or both parents are members of the military, and it may not be the same branch, right? And you've got all those interesting dynamics you've got to sort through.
Yeah. We've seen it all. We've heard it all. But yeah, they're coming in with everybody having a unique story or a unique perspective on the story. And we've offered military services since 2020, and we've seen such amazing progress with families. So we've served about 1,000 families that have come across our care and our services. And we've really seen a lot of the families have reduction in PTSD symptoms, depression, anxiety. Same for the Keiki coming in. They've seen reduction in depression and anxiety. We hosted some social groups for them to come. So kids that have, you know, like experience where they can meet other kids and they could talk about what they're going through. And just having that sense of belonging and that sense of, hey, I'm not the only one going through it, really inspires hope.
Well, you know, I for a time grew up on a military base, and I have memories of going to the PX and the commissary, and then they have a little playground out in front. And I learned how to make friends because you're constantly, you know, in a new situation with kids you don't know. And it's a good skill to have when you move around from place to place.
It does. And you know, you use your sometimes your adverse experiences as, you know, your gift to give back to the world in later years. I myself was a military spouse. My husband deployed back right after 9/11. So I did move around quite a bit. And it has its pros and cons. Thinking about it afterwards, now Hawaii is my home, but I never would have moved around. I probably would never have gotten off of, you know, Connecticut and where I grew up. So what we do is we capitalize on our strengths and our stories that were provided for us.
Coming from news and having to cover stories, let's say when a ship pulls in, aircraft carrier pulls in, and then the families reunite. It was neat to see the parents seeing their child for the first time because they weren't there for the birth of their child. Or just seeing how big the kids have gotten, you know. So that joy of reuniting as a family unit was always really a fun one to cover.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, my husband and I didn't have kids when he deployed, but just seeing them after, you know, post-deployment or after a year of being gone, it's such a joyful moment. But then on the back end, of course, all of the deployment issues sometimes creeps in and being able to transition back home or sometimes, you know, for us, transition out of the military and settle down and regrow roots. It can be hard. It can be challenging. It is unique. It's hard for our well-being. It's hard for our mental health sometimes. And you just need that support for someone that has the same lived experience. And that's where we're aiming to offer. And I think it's really going to impact Hawaii, these services, because it offers that uniqueness to really take care of our community.
And then as far as funding, because you are helping the military families, I mean, does the military provide any funding for those programs?
Not right now. So we do have some grants. We do have a VA, Sergeant VA Fox grant that is funded through the VA that offers people screening for suicide and offering suicide prevention. So that's actually funded through the federal government. Then we have a private grant from Bob Woodruff Foundation, and they fund some of the operational and some of the care that we give to the military children that are coming in. And then some of our services are funded through a philanthropist who funds our Cohen Military Family Services. That offers shorter, more acute care. And then our longer-term services are predominantly funded through insurance. So we do take HMSA, we take TRICARE, we take TRICOS. So again, we're braiding the funds along to provide the services, but we would love to see the DOD and other folks step up and really help us be better partners in taking care of our military community.
Right. But so since the start of this program, then focusing on military families, like how many families do you think you might have helped?
We've helped over 1,000.
Wow.
Okay. Over 1,000. And we have so much to do. We get about 30 to 40 referrals a week, and we only have a 2-week wait. So a lot of times, like with the VA, there'll be months and months of waiting to see a clinician. We've really staged ourselves so we can see a family within 2 weeks of their first point of entrance. And if they're acute, if they want to talk to someone right away, we will make same day arrangements for them.
Yeah, but that's terrific, though, that you're able to support the families here that make up Hawaii, right?
It's all
part of our community.
Absolutely. I mean, they deserve it. And they deserve to have services that work. They deserve to have services offered by those who have similar experiences and that really be taken care of. Our military community is important here in Hawaii, and we're happy to serve them.
Anything else for 2025 that you want to share with our listeners?
We have some really great models of care, transition to success. So we're really promoting that, collecting data around 21 social determinants of health. That model really helps people strengthen their areas of wellness and end the cycles of poverty. So we really are expanding on that one. And so maybe for a future show or a future talk story, we can dive a little deeper into transition to success. But that is on our horizon, and we're very excited about it too.
Yeah. Anything else just about, you know, marking this anniversary, though? I mean, it's a big milestone.
Yeah, we are celebrating all year. So, you know, 125 is a humongous milestone. And we are really celebrating with our community. We launched a huge carnival back in October, Ohana Lea, and it brought in over 500 families just to give back and celebrate with the community. And of course, this year we have our annual meeting that's coming up that we are just holding that's more intimate with our key stakeholders that have invested in Hawaii in Child and Family Service. And then we have our gala that wraps up the year because, of course, we need to fundraise as a nonprofit.
And when is that?
Our gala will be in September.
September, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Details to follow.
Details to follow.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks so much.
That was Amanda Pump, President and CEO of Child and Family Service, talking to us about its efforts to help military families as the organization marks its 125th anniversary this year. Now it's time to crack open the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the two Madagascar ring-tailed lemurs residing at the Honolulu Zoo. Now, their group is considered one of the most endangered kinds of primates due to habitat destruction. We asked you to name the twin lemurs at the zoo, and we gave you a hint that they're named after two local funny men. Well, to tell you the answer, here's a clip with one of the namesakes himself, Frank De Lima. I have to say, I did go walking at the Honolulu Zoo, and you have a namesake there.
Yes, I do, the lemurs.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, oh, I want to be a Madagascar lemur. That's what I really want to be. So I did that song. I remember when that came out. Oh, my goodness. Did you find the Madagascar lemurs? And did you see my namesake?
Yes.
Also Melkabang.
Yes.
Yeah, they named it Frank and Mel.
Frank and Mel are the lemur duo. And, you know, we had lots of people calling in, but no one got it right. So we have no winners. But that is our quiz for today. If you have one, write to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
HPR celebrates the life of our former president and general manager, Jose Fajardo. Join me, DJ Mermaid, for a Bridging the Gap throwback from December 2020 when Jose guest hosted with me. Our DJ El Presidente took us on an epic journey through his eclectic music picks. Join us for this special presentation of Bridging the Gap this Saturday night at 6 on HPR 1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
You know, earlier this month, we featured the annual drive for eyeglasses and hearing aids that took place across the state. The Lions Club says it collected hundreds of pairs of prescription and sunglasses, as well as a number of hearing aids. Well, we are taking time this week to explore issues around vision care. Dr. Netta Nickpour is an ophthalmologist with Jenkins Eye Care. She's worked in remote places across the world, like the Himalayas and the Marshall Islands. She sits on an advisory board with Project Vision, which regularly does screenings in our schools. She talked with us about what she's seeing out in the community.
So keratoconus is a condition of the cornea where the cornea can become weakened or thinned. And as the cornea weakens, it starts to kind of bulge forward. So that's why it's called keratoconus. Kerato is cornea and conus is cone-shaped. So the cornea becomes kind of cone-shaped. And the cornea is really important for focusing light on the retina and producing a clear quality image. And when it becomes cone-shaped or distorted, the vision gets really irregular. And it's something that is known to be progressive and can progress from eye rubbing. And so we know that kids that have really bad allergies can rub their eyes from their allergies and they can progress more. And so the question is it environmental or is it genetic? Because obviously there's a lot of fog and there's a lot of things that can lead to environmental allergies on the Big Island. And so there is a lot more allergy there and a lot more eye rubbing. But it's interesting that it's specifically more, we saw way more advanced patients coming from Hilo than from like conicide. And you kind of wonder if some of it's genetic. So we actually did a genetic study to try to answer that question of whether it was more genetic or environmental. But then the company that we were doing the study with actually like went bankrupt. And so we never ended up getting the results. So hopefully they're like going through a reorganization and hopefully we'll be able to actually get the genetic information from all the patients that we like took samples and sent. But it could be just that, you know, there's more VOG and there's more allergy and eye rubbing, but it also could be that there are certain populations that are more at risk based on their genetics because it's also a genetic condition.
So this isn't something that you do to yourself when you spend too much time on an iPhone or anything like that?
No, yeah. And parents are always like, oh, did my kid, are they on the computer too much? Are they on the iPad too much? No, it's not. It's a genetic condition. There's like a genetic predisposition. And then eye rubbing can cause it to get worse. So there's a question of whether, you know, if you had normal genetics and a normal cornea, can you rub your cornea enough to cause keratoconus? Most people think probably not. You probably have to actually carry the gene for it and then also rub your eyes. So that's the number one thing that I would tell parents to tell their kids is if you see your kids rubbing their eyes, try to get them to stop rubbing their eyes. And if they're rubbing because they're itchy, then, you know, they can see an eye doctor and get an exam and start allergy drops. Because the thing with keratoconus is the sooner you catch it and the sooner you treat it, the better patients do. Because if we catch it early, there's actually a treatment called cross-linking, where we basically soak the cornea in these vitamin B eye drops and then shine a UV light. And that causes these bonds to form in the cornea that strengthen the cornea. And then we can actually stop or at least slow the progression of the disease. And so if we catch it while the shape is mostly normal and do that treatment, then we can prevent them from going on to needing, you know, like a corneal transplant or a much more invasive procedure later.
So this is why you're going to bat for more of these screenings in the schools.
Exactly. So we've been working with Project Vision Hawaii and Vision to Learn. They've been amazing partners. And, you know, we're still kind of going through some of the logistics of getting the Department of Education on board and identifying like the correct age range in schools, where to screen and when to screen and working it into their protocols. Some of that's still a little bit of a work in progress, but Project Vision Hawaii has been awesome at actually doing screenings in whatever capacity they can. So I worked with a company that basically helped us get some devices donated to PVH to do additional screening tests at the screenings they're already doing. And they actually take like a map of the cornea to look for an irregular shape. And so that's been something they've incorporated. And yeah, so they're out there and they're screening, and the volunteers that they have and the employees they have are doing incredible, incredible work already screening for, you know, things like the need for glasses. But now they've added this to their screening too.
Well, you know, when did we start to say, hey, you know, why is it that these cases are more prevalent there on the Big Island?
That's a good question. You know, I think it's something that a lot of us who have done cross-linking have observed anyway, because I don't think that's anything new. I think it was just within the last couple of years. Like, you know, I moved here 4 years ago, and as a cornea specialist, I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. why is it that the patients from the Big Island have more keratoconus? And that's something that I'd heard other people in the community had observed. And I, you know, I'm a little bit interested in studies and have some interest in trying to actually answer these questions instead of just like wondering about them, you know? And so then I started talking to people about like, okay, well, can we design a study? Can we actually look at this? Can we figure out, instead of just saying, okay, maybe there's more keratoconus coming from the Big Island, isn't that interesting? I was like, well, can we figure out A, is that true, by doing like a genetic study? And then B, if it is true, can we actually identify those patients and like screen these kids in schools earlier so we can catch them earlier and try to get the teams that are in the schools anyway, the equipment that they need to actually make this diagnosis and then like refer them off to an eye care provider who can evaluate whether they have keratoconus or not. And so I think, as you probably know, like some of the work that I've done in the past, I spent a year doing nonprofit work with Cure Blindness Project, which is a nonprofit that's really involved in like public health and screenings and thinking about problems from all angles. And so that's kind of where, when I came in, I, you know, a couple of people were already thinking about it and kind of doing some work, and I just helped put the right people in touch and get the people that are doing all the right things to work with each other to take the best care of people.
Well, you know, I have two friends who are going blind. You know, you just kind of wonder that whole experience, and particularly if it's a child, if it's somebody who is losing their sight early on.
Unfortunately, there are some forms of blindness, especially like in older patients, there are some forms of blindness that we can't treat, like, you know, macular degeneration, there's some treatment for, but a lot of people lose vision. And despite treatment, sometimes you're just doing everything you can to preserve the vision they have. In kids, like you say, it's like even more tragic when a child has poor vision, because there's been studies that have shown this. And in my experience, I've definitely seen this. When you have kids that have poor vision, they don't see that well, so they don't do as well in school. If they're not doing as well in school, then they don't get good jobs. And there's definitely a link between keratoconus and a lower socioeconomic status. And I think the sooner we can identify children that have keratoconus and treat them, like I said, we can preserve their vision so they go on to actually do well in school and get good jobs and can kind of break that cycle for the family. The nice thing with keratoconus is if you catch it and you treat it, then they can have a totally normal life and totally normal vision. And if you don't, it is still treatable because they can have a corneal transplant, but that surgery is, you know, has a lot more risk to it and a lot more implications for their life after.
Well, how early do we test for vision in our schools?
You know, Roger Ead is an optometrist who's kind of taken the primary role of coming up with the vision screenings for the schools. And I believe they're starting screenings as early as 4 or 5, but I am honestly not 100% sure exactly what age, because I know they have like a rotating schedule. So it's not like every school gets screened every year just because of the manpower that's required. So some schools might be screening later in elementary school, and some schools might get the screening comes to their school. Say if it's on like a 3-year cycle, they might not catch them until their third year.
Right. And you know, I think the idea is that you would think that if your child is having vision problems, that you would, you know, flag it to the child's doctor, to the pediatrician, and then you can go from there. But, you know, some kids don't see doctors periodically. So if you can catch it in the schools in a screening, then it just gives them a better shot at keeping
And one of the things that kids do, which, you know, a primary care provider, like a pediatrician's nurse or tech might not necessarily know this because they have so many things that they need to do in addition to just checking vision. But when kids are getting their vision checked, a lot of times they'll peek around the eye that's being covered. And so if they have one good eye and one bad eye, they don't want to fail the test, so to speak. And so they're going to cheat and they're going to peek with their good eye. And so they're going to actually fool the examiner, and people are going to think that they have normal vision when they don't. So that's where, if hopefully there's parents that listen to this, especially on the Big Island, and if they hear this and they're like, oh, weird, my kids are always rubbing their eyes, maybe just do something simple like cover one eye, cover the other eye, and ask if they see equally out of the two eyes, you know, and just try to do like a very simple assessment of your child's vision as they're aging. And especially if they're rubbing, especially if there's any poor vision, then they really need to get in to see an eye doctor.
Well, you know, as a kid, I had allergies, and I was always hearing that, don't rub your eyes.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah,
they're itchy.
Good. Well, I'm glad whoever told you, they hopefully hopefully spared you from any problems.
Yeah, but that's the thing, is that you can just do some physical damage just with the friction.
Definitely.
Wow. Any other symptoms that parents need to know about if they think their child might have this disease?
Yeah, sometimes kids can be squinting, and squinting a lot of times is just to overcome any kind of poor vision because they're basically making like a pinhole with their eyelids, and so that can help. Sometimes they can complain that they see a lot of like glare or starbursts at night, and so if they have a lot of difficulty with their night vision, that can be another symptom.
Anything else that you think you want our listeners to know about since you've come over here and are really noticing things that maybe, I don't know, other doctors, you know, wasn't on their radar?
You know, I guess one thing that would be great for listeners to know is I have been very surprised by how many patients I've seen with white cataracts or very, very, you know, like we call them hypermature cataracts or cataracts that cause total blindness in Hawaii. Like I literally saw a patient last week who had complete total cataracts in both eyes. She could not even see your hand waving in front of her face, with insurance, living in the U.S., living in Hawaii. And I'm like, gosh, are these people scared of having surgery? Like, you know, why is it that they're waiting so long to get care? And I think a lot of times people are just scared. I think people are just scared of having surgery, and eye surgery sounds really scary. And so I would just want people to be aware that cataract surgery is the most commonly performed surgery in the U.S. It's one of the safest procedures in all of medicine. With a good surgeon, it takes 8 to 10 minutes to do surgery, and patients are generally pretty comfortable within a few days, maybe even by the next day. I have a lot of patients go back to work the day after surgery and their eyes just a little scratchy and a little sensitive. And for most people, within a couple of days to a week, the vision's actually pretty good after surgery. So I think there's no reason in the world why people should wait so long to the point that they're completely blind before they see an eye doctor and try to get a referral to get cataract surgery. Because I'm used to seeing total cataracts in Ethiopia where people live hundreds of miles from the nearest eye surgeon. But in Hawaii, where we have so many great surgeons, that really shouldn't happen. People shouldn't be suffering like that and living for years without vision until they go and get it treated.
That was Dr. Netta Nickpour, who was talking to us about an uptick of cases of keratoconus on the island of Hawaii and about vision in general. The Department of Education tells us that historically the health department used to conduct vision and hearing tests statewide, but it has not been funded for many years. Project Vision Hawaii and another group, Vision to Learn, screen some 22,000 school children every year with the priority of Title I schools in underserved communities. DOE says the availability of screening depends on funding and volunteers, but it does prioritize at high-risk age groups.
With your support, HPR shared stories about the fires in Lahaina, revealing the big picture, while also sharing the smaller, personal stories of recovery and healing.
Ice cream! Come get your ice cream! Ooh.
That's the call of the ice cream aunties in Lahaina. Trinette Furtado sits on the back of her truck announcing free treats on a megaphone as she does her weekly rounds through West Maui neighborhoods. While Furtado dishes out aloha and ice cream for those of all ages, Keiki can spin a wheel to win toys, snacks, sprinkles for their ice cream, and other prizes.
Go ahead. What do we have?
Support the stories that inspire, inform, and connect. Visit our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, to donate.
You know, now we turn our attention to a Hawaii resident who has struggled with vision loss and who wants to pass on her life lessons to others. Vicki Kennedy was diagnosed with a genetic eye disease, commonly known as tunnel vision, back in 1978. A healthy periphery is 180 degrees, but Vicki's sight was a diminished 19 degrees, making her legally blind. The disease was so rare in Hawaii that her doctors knew very little about it. After she and her family relocated to California, Kennedy connected with researchers and members of the blind community. She served as president of the Northern California affiliate of the Foundation Fighting Blindness for almost a decade before moving back to Honolulu. She recently sat down with the Conversations Lillian Song to talk about living with blindness and helping others adjust to losing sight.
Now, I had perfect 20/20 vision. So when I was starting to bump into things, push my cart into the corner of a display, one time I almost flipped right over my father, who was kneeling down, and I came from the kitchen to the lanai, and I almost flipped right over him, and he says, "Didn't you see me?" And I said, "No." So right then and there, I made an appointment with my optometrist, and he did a very, very primitive graph with a white tip on a black slate. And he says, "You know, Vicki, this is just a very primitive type of a test, but I think it's your periphery. You should have seen this white dot way before it came in towards the center. I suggest you either go to a neurosurgeon and then go see an ophthalmologist." So that's what I did. And, you know, in those days, we didn't have MRI. We didn't have CAT scan. We had all the more primitive tests. And nothing showed up. And then about another 2 months, Dr. Donald Srote, who has since passed, he said, "I think I found the problem, but I'm not sure if I am correct." He says, "You may have this disease called retinitis pigmentosa. It's going to be causing a blindness in the future. Just to be sure, I want you to go to the Jill Stein Eye Institute on the UCLA campus." And so I did. And he says, "This time I want you to take your son with you because this retinitis pigmentosa is a genetic disease." My son George Russell and I went to Los Angeles and we both went through the tests. It was diagnosed that I indeed had retinitis pigmentosa. And George is a carrier, but he does not have any trace of that. Thank God, because he's a cinematographer. So I'm so glad that he is doing well and his eyesight is normal right now. He is now 56 going on 57. So he's showing no symptoms.
You were a young woman, only
in your 30s. I was 32.
To have the red flag go up for you when you trip over your own dad.
Yes. I was devastated. I could not believe what I was hearing. How could I have this? And I had various conversations with God, which wasn't always a very pleasant one. It was always, "Why me? What did I do to deserve this?" And then as I so-called grew up, I thought, you know what? It is what it is. There's nothing I can do about it. So I have to get out of the rut because it's not good to be in a depressive mood when I have a lot of responsibilities. I was not only a mother, but I was also a teacher back at Sacred Hearts Academy. When you suffer a loss, whether it be a loved one, your pet, a sight loss, it is still a loss. You go through all of these emotional pains, feeling dejected, feeling so, so lost, and you are angry, and you get depressed. Those are all normal feelings, but you can't stay there. You can't stay in a depressed mood. You can't stay in an angry mood because you're only gonna be worse than you were to begin with, you know? Right. When I was diagnosed, there was no one. There was really nothing out there to learn from. Unfortunately, I was the first person with RP for my ophthalmologist. I didn't know anybody else here in Honolulu who had RP. And there were no talking computers. There were no support groups for the blind. Mm-hmm. Research was being done back in the East, but it didn't reach Hawaii yet. And really, I was at a loss. I couldn't even speak with my ophthalmologist because he didn't know too much about it either. He said, I've read about it. I've never had a patient with this disease. I think I may have been either the first or the second person with RP here in Honolulu back in the day. But moving forward to today, when I come across people who are newly diagnosed going blind, I say, you know what? I know it's going to be very hard for you to adjust, but just know that blindness is not the end of the world. It's a little hump in the middle of the road. Your blindness is what you make it to be, mm-hmm. okay? Today, it's a good thing you are becoming blind now, because in this time of your life, with what is going on with AI and assistive technology, we have talking computers, our iPhones talk to us, and then now I have these glasses called the Meta Ray-Ban glasses. I'm mm-hmm. sure you've heard about this.
I've been hearing about this.
I have one, and it reads to me.
Wow.
If I say, hey, Meta, look and tell me what you see. Hey, Meta, look and read to me what's in my hand. So,
wow.
You know, yes, it is still a loss. And you can still be angry because you didn't want this in your life,
this.
Okay?
Yeah.
This is something that just happens to you so naturally, and it sneaks up on you. But look at all the help that you have today. Researchers are going rampant at the Foundation Fighting Blindness, okay? Everybody is so in tune with what is going on in the research world. And then in the meantime, you have the assistive technology, and you have support groups, and you have different organizations, okay? I belong to the Hawaii Association of the Blind, and we have different age groups. So we go from little kids, about 10 years old, to kupuna. I think I'm at the max of the age limitations with HAB right now. But you're not alone. You have other people you can interact with. When I was diagnosed, there was no one.
What a different world you were in. Computers weren't invented yet.
Yeah, nothing. So from 91, that's when things really started to happen for me with the eyes
issue.
In
what ways?
Because we were in the Bay Area, I got very much connected with UC Berkeley and also UCSF, because they had two departments of ophthalmology there that concentrated on retinitis pigmentosa, or better yet called retinal degenerative diseases. I was involved with that, and then I got into a support group of the Foundation Fighting Blindness, a research group back in the East Coast. When I got involved with them, then they made me the point person to talk to newly diagnosed people going blind. They gave me a phone with an 800 number in my own home, and everybody would call me to say, I've just been diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, or I'm going blind with macular degeneration, or these other diseases, and I'm calling you because I heard you can help me. So that's what I did. I listened, and that's when I came up with, you know, it's a bump in the road, and I said, you have to get to know what it's all about and prepare yourself for the future, for when you might go totally blind.
So you're able to counsel others who are getting this diagnosis.
Because I could relate. And by doing that and talking with all of these people, it was good for me too because it was so cathartic. And that was the beginning of where I started to blossom.
You were connecting the dots because you yourself, you had no resources.
No.
As somebody who is legally blind, navigating the world is different.
It is very, very different. Mm-hmm. And you feel lonely. And I noticed that I would use the cane from time to time. But, you know, I had such pretty good sight that I didn't feel the need to use the cane. But when I would use the cane in a real big group of people, then they don't want to talk to me. You know, we don't see that well, but you can feel things,
you
right?
You can sense it still.
Yeah. Okay, now, by this time, I'm seeing a big difference. Now, let's say a little bit larger than a straw, but it was a little bit deformed. It's like you're having Pele's hair around a chicken wire. And it got worse and worse. And I thought, okay, I think I'm going to be blind. And so I was using the cane. In 2000, I came off the bus going back home from San Francisco. Mind you, the exit from the freeway came down on 7th Street in Benicia. And there were 6 lanes.
And you have to cross this?
I have to cross. So I knew where to go. So I get off the bus, I go to the corner, and I stuck my cane out, and I was walking in the crosswalk. And I kept walking and walking and walking. And then I started hearing the cars speeding on my left side. Without knowing, I was veering to my left, and I never got to the sidewalk. So I was walking down the street, and I thought, oh, dear God, please help me. And nobody honked their horns or stopped me or anything.
But you were very dangerously close.
Yes, absolutely. And so I stuck up my cane to the right, and I tried to find my way back to the curb.
Okay.
Got to the curb, and I said, thank you, God. My heart was pounding a mile a minute, and then I walked 4 blocks back home, and I hung up my cane. I went to the phone in the kitchen, and I called up Guide Dogs for the Blind. And I said, this is Vicki Kennedy. I am ready for my dog.
And that was 25 years ago. These days, Kennedy is aided by her third guide dog, Buddy. The 78-year-old Dynamo has also served on various boards, including Hawaii Fido and Service Dogs and the Hawaii Association of the Blind. We can tell you that the association's 58th convention is coming up in March. It's a resource and a way to connect with the blind community. That does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to honor 5 decades of teaching. Holy Family Catholic School salutes one of its own, and you'll get to meet her. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.